Welcome to the Nerd Party.
I'm Darren Moser.
I'm Philip Gilfus.
I'm Daniel Prue.
And this is City Alpha 3.
Hello and welcome to City Alpha 3, a Star Trek podcast here on the Nerd Party. I'm Philip Gilfus, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-strandineers, Daniel Prue and Darren Moser. Daniel, what's going on? How's your Star Trek life in this, what we call it, the mid-season hiatus?
The drought.
Yeah. Oh, hey, yes, if it, you know what we should do, since we're in the drought, we should plant a tree here in the town square to symbolize our survivalness and never-ending surrender to the Nova that will very shortly kill us all.
Right. Do we have enough room in the plaque for that, Daniel? Because that seems like a bit of a mouthful.
You know what? We're probably not even going to have time to finish the plaque, so maybe we should just get this this transmission sent so somebody someday in the future will at least know that there was a podcast at one time called City Alpha 3 here.
They'll actually be our guest co-host if they get this.
Yeah, through the magic of editing.
All right. Darren, how goes all things Trekness with you?
Good. Just in finding good spots for a couple of the Eagle Moss figures that I have to keep my desk ship shape, but watching some good old classics.
Ship shape. Nice.
But yeah, just watching some good classic episodes. I think I really need to do? I just need to do a straight TOS rewatch, because I swear there are episodes I have not seen or vaguely remember. So
yeah, I need to do that.
Lord
too.
Help me. I should do that.
Yeah, with upcoming Trexmas, I've sort of been organizing some parts of the household here. So I've sort of rearranged a lot of my stuff in the Trek room here. So, kind of making stuff show up a little bit more. Took out some micro machines because I always just keep them all in a tin, my Star Trek micro machine. So, you know, I like to see things out and move things around a little bit so that way you get to enjoy things a bit more.
Is it like the butterscotch tin that everybody loves, and then you open and you're like, oh man, it's just freaking Star Trek toys. Thought it was delicious cookies.
Yeah. Mine's actually a Coca-Cola tin, but yes.
Wait a minute.
They don't sell Coca-Cola in a tin, Philip.
How the hell does that work?
You East Coast guys and your weird packaging.
Wait, don't put me in that boat. I don't know what the heck he's talking about.
You have to remember I'm older than both of you, so back when we got Coke.
Bro, from the Coke man who would walk around uphill in the snow both ways.
So late 1930s, maybe 35, The Guardian.
The joke was always that the Coke man could be your father. Yeah, you know, come on.
Oh, man.
But anyway, we are not just talking about Coke today, but it may pop up. Get it, Pop. You Westerners will get it. But there's a subject that I've been kind of interested in tackling, and so this is going to be part one of a, perhaps part two or part three series, depends on how lazy I am about it. But I'm interested in Trek outside of Trek, and what does that mean? So I'm talking about there are Star Trek episodes that take place sort of outside of your usual starship missions, and you're just sort of in this other world, or, you know, whether it's Earth or somewhere else, and it's just sort of people living their lives, and like that's the whole episode, and you're kind of like, well, that was either refreshing or terrible, depending on how the episode was. And so I know that I'm going to go against Philip rules and go... instead of going in my usual in-canon continuity order, I'm going to go in air order. And that means tackling actually two of...
Mark the date, Daniel. This is a day that'll live in infamy.
Mark it in the log, number one. But the two episodes I've chosen, you know, from the original series and The Next Generation, that are sort of Trek outside of Trek, are regarded sort of arguably as fan favorites, if not the fan favoritist of all. So for TOS, we're going to be talking about The City on the Edge of Forever. And for The Next Generation, we'll be talking about The Inner Light. So we'll start first in the world of all things TOS. And, you know, this is pretty much going to be free for all, just because we're talking about two episodes for this whole episode. But I'll start, Daniel, City on the Edge of Forever. Just general thoughts about what you thought about You know, I'm not going to summarize the episode. Everyone knows it. But just generally Kirk and Spock and McCoy sort of chilling out in, you know, Depression era America, Earth.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, obviously, what am I going to say? It's not good. It's good. It's a good episode. It's a really strong. The setup for the premise, I think, is kind of silly. The whole, I thought upon rewatching it this time, the whole Cordrazine, I think is what it's called, when he's like literally Kirk second guesses McCoy. This substance is so dangerous that he can administer it on the bridge, but one or two stray drops is going to send you into like this paranoid, you know, crazy episode. And my God, the whole hyperspray is empty. I thought that was kind of silly.
Murderers! Assassins!
It's a little over the top, but you know what? That's par for the course of TOS, so it doesn't detract or anything like that. Once they get into the time travel and like the mystery and what do we do, what's supposed to happen, really good stuff. Really good stuff. And of course, there's a lot of lightheartedness in this episode. It's generally, you know, you generally think of it as a heavier episode, and of course it ends that way, and there's some heavy themes to it, but there's a lot of jokes going on throughout this episode. And the Spock-Kirk stuff, the fish-out-of-water stuff, is really, really good. I really enjoy that aspect of the episode as well.
Darren is put on his stocking cap.
I need to make sure you can't tell that I'm a Vulcan, so I put on this stylish beanie. As you could tell, I'm Chinese, and my ears were caught in a rice picking machine. Yeah,
that was a little crazy.
Yeah, I know. I was like, am I supposed to find that funny, or is it racist? Or I don't know.
I mean,
I don't know.
Data
anyway,
is at least a better friend.
Let's just say that he was playing to the times, I guess. I don't know what I'm saying.
You could say that about a lot of TOS, but let's not go there. Philip, I've been programmed to talk about these episodes in one way. I cannot change. But like Daniel said, I mean, this is it's a good episode. It's one of those that often I may not like jump to just because, you know, at least right now with TOS, I'm more interested in trying to find things that I haven't seen or revisit. And it's like, you know, it's like All Good Things or something like that, where it's like you're not just going to be like, oh, let's always watch All Good Things, you know. But this is a real, you know, it's definitely a fan favorite. And, you know, like Daniel said, the premise takes a little bit to get there. But, man, some of the banter between Kirk and Spock in 1930s Backlotia USA there. I mean,
I did stop the Netflix at one point because I'd watch it with my wife. And point out, because I guess this is a mansplaining moment, so I apologize. But I did, like, you know, what does that sign say? She's like, Floyd's Barbershop. Oh, wait a minute. This is Andy Griffith. They're using Andy Griffith set. Yeah.
Hey, they have one establishing shot, exterior shot of New York City in this episode.
That's all you need.
You should know exactly.
That's all
where
you need. Yeah, and like three cars drive by in the entire episode, but, you know. No, and
well, one doesn't really drive.
Soon, or
but no, but the late? But the banter was great, and especially when Kirk is like, "Well, I guess I'm asking too much of you, Spock, to actually fix this, you know, tricorder." And the look Spock gives, Spock is just the master of looks, and he's just like, "No, you did not just throw that down." And you know, from them being caught by the policemen. And it's just, you know, it's always hard to do, you know, I mean, yeah, there's the fish out of water, and I think they play it really well. Like, Kirk and Spock are smart. Like, they're not going to make too many, you know, fumbles of revealing things. But there's also the fact that you really need someone. It just, like, it all depends on more who they run into. And I mean, Edith Keeler is like hand-picked to meet these guys. Like, she's basically in the 24th century already in her mind. Yeah. But
yeah, and I, what do y'all think? Because I sort of think it reminds me of the fact that, and I say, when you say fan favorite, you never know what that means, because people will be listening like, oh, that's not my favorite. But typically, or stereotypically, as far as Enterprise, a fan favorite, or so we're told, is the two Mirror Universe episodes in A Mirror Darkly, which, of course, doesn't take place during Enterprise. You know what I mean by that.
So you mean, like, critically acclaimed sort of like, versus fan favorite? Is that what you mean? Or
Well, yeah, I mean, like, people like In a Mirror Darkly, like, oh, like, name your favorite Enterprise episode, and people say in the top five, and it's like, but that doesn't take place during Enterprise. Like, you're like an Enterprise episode that's not about an Enterprise. But, and so, you know, here you have City on the Edge of Forever, and this is, you know, stereotypically regarded as the best episode of the original series. Of course, doesn't take place in space on a starship, you know. And do you think, you all think that that's weird, or just, you know, speaks in and of itself about the characters? You know, there's no... I mean, I was going to say there's no Scotty or her. There are, but you know what I mean. Like, 2 seconds.
She's afraid, and he's unsure, and they got three lines apiece.
Her one line this episode, that was a little cringeworthy as well.
Yeah.
Captain, frightened. It's like, really?
It's like Worf getting beat up by the bad guys, so you know they're tough. It's like Uhura's got to say she's frightened, so you know it's a dangerous situation. It's like, no, you don't need to do that.
You know, it's, I think what it does when people say some of these episodes are their favorite episodes, I think it shows the sort of diversity that Star Trek can have, this sort of breadth of storytelling that you get with this premise. You know, it doesn't, there are quote unquote traditional Star Trek episodes. There are typical Star Trek episodes, but Star Trek has the flexibility to kind of go outside of those bounds in ways that a lot of other storytelling can't do. So they can do A City on the Edge of Forever. They can do Inner Light and some of these other episodes. And like you said, some of them maybe don't work so well. But again, what other, you know, I guess you could do, well, I shouldn't say I guess, you could do something like this in, like, a lot of these episodes in Doctor Who. But and maybe some, like, Quantum Leap-ish stuff. But not a lot of...
We're not talking about Enterprise this episode, Daniel. This is
not a lot of, you know, storytelling can do this sorts of things. And... So it doesn't surprise me that when Trek stretches itself, those tend to be some of the more fan favorite-y episodes. I think that's just a testament to what Star Trek can do.
Yeah, and I've been reading. I started reading a Doctor Who novel. It's the first Doctor Who novel, and it's a history. It takes place during the Salem Witch Trials, but it's trying to embrace the old Doctor Who. Especially the first Doctor, the history is where there's no aliens, there's no, you know, it's just the history of Earth and, you know, just the complicated character stories. And so, like, you know, in Sitting on the Edge of Forever, there's no aliens, you know, like in Daniel's favorite Time's Arrow, messing around in the past. You know, there's no, it's nothing. It's just, this is the Earth history, and it's actually pretty dark. You know, a very non, what you would think, 1960s storyline that, yeah, we're going to kill her, and that's the story. But, like, you know, that's, it's just a flat, I mean, this is not a critique, obviously. It's just a flat story. There's no aliens. There's no Klingons, you know, on the Nazi planet or on the, you know, Roman planet. It's just, we're in the past, and that's the whole story.
Well, and again, in context, like meta context, you know, this is like us making a movie or making an episode and reflecting on the 80s. That's really how far the 30s were from the 60s. Like, they weren't that, it wasn't that long ago. Like, many people still remembered that, you know, that's what they grew up in or their parents lived through. So, I mean, we're a good deal more removed from that. But, yeah, it's, I think, like you said, Daniel, I mean, sci-fi and especially Star Trek is the bet, it's a really good medium for these almost impossible questions, almost like bar talk questions or something like that, where you're like, well, what if you had to decide if a one woman dies in the 30s or millions of people die in like the 40s? Like again, like it, that's because that's what it really all comes down to with like Edith Keeler. And, you know, I think some of the best Trek episodes, they answer some of these questions, and you have like, how would Spock handle, you know, antiquated technology, and what would Kirk do if he, you know, fell in love with someone and had to choose that they died for the greater good? Like, yeah, the framing is this huge, extravagant, like, you know, takes a lot of setup to get us there, but it's sci-fi has done, always does a good job of these really hypothetical, but with these characters, you do think about it, like, yeah, it would be difficult if you fell in love with someone and you had to, like, that's the nature of war. Like, war is all about dehumanizing the enemy, because if you knew, you know, their names or their dreams or their personality, like, you know, then you become much more attached, because we're all human. I mean, Spock, except for Spock.
And you know what's really interesting to me about this storyline is it actually kind of flies in the face of what we would consider traditional Star Trek messaging. Like, normally, it's always you do what you can to avoid war. You always take the high road, the moral high ground. The ends don't justify the means. And there's a conversation when Spock and Kirk are talking and about Edith Keeler, and Spock says she has the right idea, she's just not in the right time. You know, basically saying that we need to let this war play out as it were going to. We need to let her die in this war to play out as it was going to, in order to restore the timeline. It's kind of different from what I would traditionally think Star Trek would find a magical third option normally. Where,
well, that's the thing. I was always thinking that they would pull her into the future because that's the future she wants. Like, that's the Star Trek, like, everybody's happy at the end. It's like, well, she's supposed to die, so we'll kill her and then bring her back to the future and she'll get to live in this paradise that she's dreaming of. But no.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of, I mean, especially for this time, and of course, not having lived at that time, I feel like I may be just stereotyping, but to me, this seems like a story that really would never be told during this time. You know, it's sort of, you know, reminds me of like how we will talk about the animated series. Is like, you look at all the cartoons that were on during the 70s and they're all like, duh, silly, and you know, blah blah blah. And then it's like the animated series of Star Trek where we make, you know, these serious stories or sci-fi stories.
Pink,
so like
with
this one,
Tribbles.
I'm like, yeah. But like, look, like whatever episodes would have been on during this, you know, like the Dick Van Dyke show or whatever, right. I don't know. But you know, and then you have, yeah, they fall in with a woman and they have to kill her. Like, yeah. Okay, that's a,
well, okay. I learned a very important lesson from Batman one time, Philip.
Okay.
You don't have to save some, or no, what is it? I don't have to kill you, but I don't have to save you. So that's actually what
Adam West said that? Oh my gosh.
No, believe it or not, it wasn't Adam West. It wasn't Ben Affleck either. It was Christian Bale's Batman that said, I don't have to kill you, but I don't have to save you. And that's exactly
what
happened.
He had to either save Edith Keeler or Spock, and that the bomb was going to blow up at the same time.
Nice. Anyway. You have to trust in the citizens of Gotham.
Is there like a theory going around in Star Trek that this is one of those like splitting points of the mirror universe?
I've heard that before.
I think I've heard that, but I don't know if that's canon, but that's, I've heard that, where it's, because again, you have, everyone always says like, oh, Germany winning World War II is like the big shift, and this kind of leads into that. I mean, Enterprise intro kind of establishes war was a little bit more before that in sailing times, but basically it's like, it, you usually start with the World War II being won by, you know, the Axis powers.
If it's true, if it's that far removed from the prime timeline, then the mirror universe is even dumber than it already is. Sorry, I know, unpopular opinion, but you can't diverge that far in the past and have ships that look exactly the same 400, 500 years in the future. Sorry, just doesn't make any sort of,
because you're going to have people live and die, a totally different generation and population of people will be in that universe based on war.
I did think it was interesting that they didn't extrapolate in this. I mean, it makes sense for the narrative, but they're not like, they don't say Earth is in a terrible situation now.
There's just not an Enterprise up there.
Because they just know that there's, yeah, exactly. That's all they know.
It's actually at the planet next door. They really kind of jumped the gun a little bit.
All they know is there's no Enterprise as they know it, and that's it. And that Germany won World War II because they had the atom bomb first. And that's all they know. For all they know, I mean, it could have worked. I mean, presumably it didn't, and it wouldn't.
This is where Daniel defends Nazis. I'm not saying Nazi Earth is bad, guys. I'm just saying.
I am saying they could have been overthrown by the Augments or by whoever or whatever.
Khan would have gone up in the 90s.
Yeah. I'm just saying it was interesting to me, and it actually makes sense because, of course, they're saying they only have limited access to information. Actually, this brings up a related point that I was going to mention earlier. The Guardian of Forever seems a little Terran-centric for me, only showing old clips.
He is waiting for a specific question.
From a specific species.
He's also a little bit analog. Like, he's cassette. Like, he's not a DVD, you know, where kind of like, can we skip tracks?
He's an 8-track,
like, no,
maybe.
Got to show the whole thing.
Well, we do see the Guardian, though, again, in the animated series. Yes. In the episode Yesteryear. Where
foolishly, the Federation Historical Society is like, let's just go poke around in the past and nothing's going to change. Apparently, they didn't watch the Butterfly Effect movie. And basically, Spock is no longer the first officer of the Enterprise, and you have an Andorian in his place, which actually sounds really awesome. But of course, we got to, you know, restore the status quo before the end of the episode.
You see, that, and that was a Vulcan-centric Guardian.
So. Maybe he's got like a stations, like 13 stations, like those old TV, and you could just, you know, depending on who's asking the question.
And then it goes with the two final ones. Anyway, so we all talked about Edith Keeler. I wanted to focus on her for a second, because when we were watching with my wife, we kind of had a reaction like, is she like weird or cool? Because she kind of like goes between those two kind of things.
She's kind of a nerd in the 30s. Like,
yeah, she's kind of spacey a little bit. Like, is she on something right now? Or anyway. But yeah, she just had these futuristic visions. But like you said, she's sort of a woman out of time from herself.
Yeah, I think they push her a little too hard. They try to make her a little too special to make her almost an unbelievable character. Like you said, she does waffle between those two positions for me, because there are certain things when she's like, when she's acting as this person working at this mission, that works well for me. Like, it's like, oh yeah. And even when, like, even some of the more heavy-handed stuff is okay. But when she's like specifically like, we're going to get to the atom bomb and then we're going to do space travel and then we're going to
travel. She's oddly specific about how the course.
I'm just saying, two nacelles, guys. It makes sense.
It's a little on the nose. It's a little much. I mean, it's okay for her to be idealistic, and that's obviously what they're going for. But just have her. I mean, she has. You would think somebody in 1930 would have enough to focus on. You don't have to start speculating 50 years into the future. Just say, hey, look, we should, all this war money, we should be all spending that on feeding the poor or whatever, because that's kind of her character is presented right. In a way that she's this pacifist, that she becomes such a powerful leader in this movement that she literally convinces the president of the United States not to go into World War II. And it seems to be more about her, do her ideals match up with Star Trek or than what would a realistic person's ideology be at that time period?
Yeah, because I have to... Well, anyway, I guess, you know, it's one of the things, don't think about it too hard, but I'm like, well, Pearl Harbor's still going to happen. So we're probably going to be war with the Japanese, but I guess just to stop the German war? I don't know. Anyway, don't think about it too hard, I guess. But yeah, and I thought... what about the Kirk-Edith relationship? Did their romance seem, you know, rushed or realistic, or, you know, Kirk just, you know, falls in love with this woman out of her time, of his time, so, and then complicates the whole mission?
Yeah, I mean, it's really well acted, and at the end, you know, how subtle, you know, where, you know, McCoy is saying, you know, don't you know what you've done, you know, and Spock just says, like, he knows, and it's like, yeah, because I think it's very well portrayed by William Shatner for his, you know, that his developing, you know, emotions for her. And again, it's just not even the love aspect. It's still the choice of, here's this nice person who is a dreamer and they speak the same language. And it's like, but you have to choose to let her die for the greater good. Like that, even without any love aspect, like, that's hard for human beings to do.
And I think they chart it pretty well with, like, you know, she has to stumble down the stairs and Kirk stops her and Spock's like, you know, she could have died. And Kirk's like, yeah, but you said it was a car, so it doesn't.
Yeah. And you know, Spock's basically saying, like, are you going to just keep saving her every moment? Like, you know, the moment's coming where you have to make this choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just think it's really good, like, the Kirk choice. And also, you know, for the stereotypes about the Kirk and women and their roles, I mean, this seems like a genuine relationship between, you know, both of them, or, you know, both falling in love or whatever. And so it's not just, like, Kirk going to seduce the woman to get what he wants, meme. But
yeah, it feels a little rushed to me, but only because limited time to tell the story, you know, and it's just a different to get it done in one episode. It's fine. I don't have a problem with it or anything like that. It's just all of a sudden he's like, I'm falling in love with Edith Keeler. I'm like, okay, all right, that's fine. If that's what we're doing, that's fine. But yeah, no, that it doesn't, like, all of it serves the ending scene, and I think that's what matters the most. So
the only thing I bumped up against, well, there was a few things, but the major thing I bumped up against, because I'm a nerd, is how did Spock get the second newspaper clipping? Because he was recording The Guardian, and so he would have gotten what we'll call a prime timeline, and so the part about Edith Keeler dying. How would he have gotten Edith Keeler, you know, talks to the president?
After McCoy went through the thing.
But that would have been after, because remember, it's analog, so it's a cassette. Well, if they went past that point, they would have had to rewind a third time.
The impression I got when they talked a lot about the river and things like that, like the fact that time was fluid enough that his tricorder was spitting out both answers, because he does see...
Okay, was it the River of Commerce?
Well, no, in the Divine Treasury, yeah. No, but the... Yeah, because like his tricorder shows, you know, Edith Keeler dies in car accident, and then it shows Edith Keeler talks to President 6 years from now. So it shows both information, but I know what you're saying. It's a little hard under scrutiny.
It also would kind of make sense, because at that point they would have been removed from that timeline. If that makes sense, that timeline would no longer exist. I guess it kind of still does. I don't know. Time travel is always confusing. You can always find silly little loopholes with it, but
yes. Now, in rewatching this episode again, and I think we've kind of said this, like I definitely would recommend listeners to watch this again, just because it's one of those episodes you think you know, and then you watch it, and you're like, oh, these little moments that I don't think I remembered. Like, McCoy, like, DeForest really gets to act a lot in this one. I mean, he's doing his whole crazy assassins, but he has, like, little sweet moments there when he's, you know, when Edith finds him, and, you know, he sort of gets the chance to do a little bit more than just saying, you know, damn it, Jim, he's dead, you know, than maybe what he usually
does. Well, he's a kind guy, and he's like, I don't know what's going on, but, you know, I'm just going to keep going and doing what I do.
And he's kind of cool. Like, he's a little bit of the McCoy charm. Like, I've decided you're not an hallucination.
I don't know if this is the first time we get this attitude from McCoy, but when he's hallucinating and he had just got on the planet and he's trying to figure out where he is, and, oh, this is Earth, and he's like, take me, if this is like a museum, take me to the hospitals. I want to see when they sew people up, like, I think he says, like, clothing or something like that. Anyways, we get that attitude that we see, of course, again in Star Trek 4, that he considers this era, or you know I guess to him ancient medicine is something to be kind of despised. His kind of negative attitude towards it, he's cutting people up, you know, and it's I thought that was actually kind of a cool thing. I don't know if it was a specific reference to this scene in Star Trek 4, but it's that same exact attitude about the same exact issue. So I really like that.
And then one thing, and this has become me as a writer, I noticed this, and I was like, why? Did you run short and needed to add these two things? Because in other words, like, there's the part at the beginning when McCoy steals a phaser, I think from the transporter room. And he has that phaser the whole episode, doesn't do a thing with it, until he arrives and gives it to the bomb. I'm sure he has a name. But gives it to the bum.
He doesn't give it to the bum.
No. Well, yeah, okay, you're right. But the bum takes phaser and then just overloads it and dies. I'm like, what was the point of all that? Like, we could have done without any of that.
He could just not have had it on him.
Yeah, I mean, like, what was the point of killing that guy? Just because he was, like, sexually harassing Edith Keeler? I mean, I get it. You shouldn't do that.
Oh, was that the same guy?
It was the same guy.
Oh, that's such a perfect thing, because I was actually the guy that was talking to Kirk, right?
Yeah, it's like, I know how she can shut up.
I was going to bring that moment up, because I actually really liked that moment. That was one of my favorite moments of the whole.
Progressive moment.
It was a very progressive moment. And it's like, you kind of, okay, you get it, like, how it was probably written. It's like, he's falling for her kind of a thing. But I would also like to think that none of the Star Trek characters would put up with that sort of language. Whatever he was about to say next, anybody would have been like, dude, just stop talking. Like, nope. And I thought that was... very good. I really like that part as well.
Cool. And then I think the only last thing I'll bump up against was when they come back from the Guardian. June, we're back in our Starfleet uniforms.
Oh, that's true.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
I was like, they were just in. Yeah, whatever. Let's get the hell out of here. But anyway, final thoughts about this very famous Trek against from Trek before we zoom 70 years in the future.
I cannot alter the way I record and talk about this episode.
That just means you're an old model. We're gonna wait for Guardian of Forever 10 to come out. Okay, so now we're gonna go to the next generation with the Inner Light. I think both of these guys know I don't appreciate it as much as everyone else does. And so
You're wrong, Philip.
I know. I like, there are things I liked. But anyway, so I just this is obviously, again, you do the TNG rankings. People are going to put this in their top five or top 10. I say people. But anyway, so Darren, we'll start with you this time. The Inner Light. What say you? Or perhaps you can, if you want to do it through some sort of flute solo, you're more than welcome to.
I'm not very good at the flute yet. I just stepped into this timeline where I'm apparently a podcaster. I don't even know what that is, but I'm going to be back on the Enterprise soon, guys. You just wait. My crew's going to get me. Well, we'll see how that goes. But no, like you said, it's one of those episodes where we see a tiny bits of the original, you know, of our main crew trying to do their best. But for the most part, it's all on Patrick Stewart's shoulders and surrounded by characters and actors we've never met before. So that's a very different type of episode. And even then, the whole twist and punch of like why he's there isn't given us till like the last 5 minutes of the episode. So very different pacing, very different storytelling, but it's interesting in, you know, like the flash forward leaps, because every time it cuts back to, you know, so basically he's being inceptioned and time passes differently on the Enterprise versus once you're in the dream world. He's really deep down there. But
oh, that makes total sense, because the flute would be his what do they call it? A charm? I think charm is what they call it. I can't remember his charm, but
I know what you mean. It's like a totem or something.
Totem. Yeah. Totem. That's what it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if it plays an eighth note octave when he pushes it, then he knows it's real. But no, it's, and also it's kind of cool to see Picard in this fish out of water, at least in the beginning, where it's like, yeah, what would you do if, like, is this real? Is this fiction? Like, what's going on? You know? And I mean, he's a little more subtle than McCoy's, like, good cranial capacity. You must be human-ish. It's like, let's not say that to your quote-unquote wife, Picard. That's probably not going to go over really well. But no, it's a kind story, and you know, he has a friend and he has a wife, and you know, he's still Picard. He's still like stirring up trouble, and you know, going to the elders, and you know, And because we all know Picard is although Picard, I wouldn't say he's a scientist. I would say he's a historian, you know? So, I mean, as so much as like Janeway is more of a scientist than Picard in that regard, but I don't know. But then again, Picard also as a character is older and has more experience of just dealing with things in life. That's a terrible thing to say about a character, but overall, like in rewatching this, you know, it is really poignant, because it's, you know, it's kind of almost, you know, It's a Wonderful Life-ish, where you have
Home Alone.
No, not really Elf? At all. Home Alone. No, It's a Wonderful Life, where you have, you know, these moments of a man's life, and even though it's not Picard's past that we know, you know, it's, you know, he has a family and he has grandchildren, and he's, you know, doing the best he can. But again, it's overall just very well acted by Sir Patrick Stewart. And I can definitely see how it's a fan favorite and voted in the top five for sure of Next Gen.
And this is a Sir Patrick Stewart and son production.
Which,
of course, his son plays his son.
Oh, was that actually his son? I think I'd remember.
Yeah.
I don't think I had remembered that. Time. So,
yeah.
So
it makes a lot of sense then, because he's super tall and awkward and is not.
I thought you meant the child, like in the naming ceremony. Was that his son?
No, it was funny because you see the son sort of, you know, I suppose he's supposed to be like in his 20s or 30s, and he has hair. And I remember thinking like, oh, okay, well, I guess he didn't. And then the next scene, like, oh, yep, nope, no hair. Okay, that's where it was. That was just a toupee, and they were wigging the other one. So here's a question. I know this is me being me, but just go with me. So this whole experience, the Cayman project or whatever we're going to call it, does he, and maybe the answer doesn't matter, which I'll accept, but like, is he really living this guy's life? Is it just a recording in his brain? Like, was there really a Kamen? And, you know, or is this just sort of like, this is our civilization, and if you had been plopped in it, you know, the choices you would have made? Or is he, like, quantum leaping into this guy's life? Like, what are your theories about, or do you not even think about it?
I think it falls apart if you, and this is me being, I am the nitpicker, the one that everything has to sort of make sense. And like when I watched it this time, I let it go a little bit more than I did the last time I watched it, and I enjoyed it more. I don't think there's a way to make it make sense. Because if you say, okay, he's plopped into this other person's life, well then why is that everything that he does? There's no way that this person would have done the things that he did to get him to the point that he is.
Because he's not Picard. Or he doesn't have Picard's past.
But I mean, I think it's already problematic. These people, I mean, like, they're like, whoa, we're just getting into missile technology. Okay, well then how do you have, like, life projection technology with species that you aren't even aware of? Like, I just think you have to...
They emphasized one area of technology over all others.
Yeah, I just don't understand it. Like, this society makes no sense. But that's, like, the nitty-gritty. That's, like, the detail stuff. I think the overall story is super compelling and very interesting, but if you break it down, like, I don't get it either. Like, I was thinking with you, Philip, too, maybe it's like, okay, this is just like a typical Kamen. Is it Kamen?
That's his name.
Yeah.
What was the name of the planet? Do you remember?
Catan,
thank you.
I had to write it all down.
There was lots of trading with sheep and wood and wool.
Well, this is Star Trek. Well, you know, this is 90s era Star Trek being 90s era Star Trek, where they like try to make everything old timey but also aware of things. It's just silly. I don't know, that sort of stuff it gets me frustrated because it doesn't really make any sort of sense. They can build this super advanced probe that can go off into space, obviously not too far, but
yeah, solid
with solid yeah. It was 1,000 years and it had traveled like a light year or whatever, which okay, that makes sense and that's cool. But then it can interact with the Enterprise, which is like trillions times more advanced than it, find this one guy, beam into his head some sort of experience. Okay, I'm on board with all that, but how did they even decide to do that?
How did it know to have the flute inside?
How did it know to have the flute? Unless it was tailor-made, again, you don't...
Is it like a Tom Paris Hollow novel where it's just like... You think you're in control, but you can really only go along a certain path.
I think it has to be slightly reactionary, like and obviously it's designed to ease you in and ease you out of the experience, because it starts off with him being sick, so all of the characters around him are understanding of his strange behavior. You know, it's not just like, you know, he wakes up parallel style ready to fire a torpedo, he doesn't remember the configuration. Like, it eases him in, and then at the very end it eases him out, as it's like, no, now we're gonna, you know, reveal what this is all about to you. So yeah, but I feel like again, the program, because I do think it is a program, it's not, because of how much Picard interacts with it, but it has its limits. And it, you know, like the fact that he proposes atmospheric condensers, you know, probably whatever he proposes, the guy's going to say no, because that's not in the program. But I always felt that it was based on the life of a man who had lived through this, and he became like the template. But then some of the individual choices that are made by Picard can vary it slightly. But like the death of his friend, you know, the death of his wife, the birth of his children, you know, as far as, and then again, there's a lot we don't see. I mean, supposedly years in the spaces.
I'm going to follow you on this path, Darren. If this is the case, then all of those events are carefully constructed narratives to, like you say, ease him in and ease him out.
Well, just if at the beginning and the end, in the middle.
No. The death of his friend, the death of his wife, all of those things are meant to serve the end of his time at that planet, right? Because the reveal, when his friend comes and his wife comes,
true,
and then his kids are there, that's what's the most important, significant part of that program. That's that, or quote unquote program, if we're calling it that. If that's the case, then you are. Then what is his city or province or whatever it was? Was that a real one or was that like a generic one?
Well,
at some point it's like the, what's the old, philosopher, you know, if you remove certain pieces of a ship, how many pieces can you remove before it's it's no longer the actual ship. If you start to change and alter and tinker, and their goal is cultural
education.
Relevancy or to continue on or, and they keep changing little bits of it. Is it even, what's the point? Are they even, is it worth it at that point? I don't know.
Right. Well, like I said, I feel that it's like, I didn't feel that the death of his wife, I see what you're saying that like they're coming back as the trigger, but I didn't see the death of his friend and his wife. I feel like that's what happened to the template man, to the real, Kamen. The real Kamen, I feel like, you know, he lived in a single town, you know, he had a wife, he, like all those key events happened to him. I think the wiggle room, as it were, is things like, you know, what Picard does with his day. Like, he's on the council. Like, again, like, it can, as I see what you're saying, where he could just go completely off script and start doing whatever. And granted,
Truman,
Truman Show.
He could Truman Show it and then just go to the end of the whatever. And they're like, but we have not programmed this part of the thing.
But I think it also, it is fairly well constructed in the fact that, you know, there's not a lot of technology. I mean, who knows? They could have even like backspaced their technology a bit. Like if they had, you know, if they had more advanced technology, but like that would have made the answer of getting back to his ship too apparent, you know, because basically he lives in this town his whole life. You know, he raises a family there and all they have to do is get enough buy-in in the first 10 years of his memory for him to commit to the program.
Yeah, but again, I think that would then defeat the purpose of the entire exercise. Because if you're trying to say our culture is important enough to remember, or we want to bring this to somebody, how much do you have to alter it in order? This is like way more metaphysical and like way more philosophical than the episode goes into. It's just, to me, that's why it's like, okay, you have this species and whoever, whatever percentage of it are aware that they're about to die, that they're about to be killed off, and they want to somehow preserve themselves. How best to do that? Well, this species has decided to somehow force another person or creature to face the life of somebody on their planet or whatever.
Yeah.
And once you start changing those parameters, you can change one thing here, you can change one thing there, but what is it? How far do you have to go before it's no longer typical? Or you're no, I mean, even, of course, that's a Star Trek idea anyways. This, like, a monoculture where everybody has the same experience anyways is kind of crazy. But that's why I don't even try to think of it when I watch the episode at this point, because it's just too crazy at that point.
Yeah, and maybe it's sort of, maybe he doesn't have as much choice as he does. Because one of the this viewing, I didn't have a problem with it. I know you all remember I complained about this in the past, but I didn't have a problem with it this time per se. But the relationship with his wife, who I totally wrote down her name, Aileen, or Aileen, I forget how you say it, but Aileen, I'll think is how
Aileen.
I enunciate it.
It's pronounced with an E, or it's written with an E, yeah.
Okay, so Aileen. So, you know, he comes back to her, and that's fine. I do, you know, I find, from, again, a writing and an acting standpoint, I love Jean-Luc's, like, first, like, questions about, like, is this prison? Is this a holiday? He goes through, like, every checklist, walks around.
He
like,
said
does the
both
like,
end program
he does everything
and,
you're supposed to do.
You know, holodeck off at the same time. Like, I don't know what more you could have wanted.
This is
him.
Not his first time waking up in a strange scenario. That's all I'm saying.
You know, I'm actually surprised he didn't bring up Q. Like, that would have been, like, the third thing.
That would have been a great call-out. That would have been amazing.
But, like, he walks the perimeter of the town, makes sure it's not a holodeck, right? Throws a rock against the wall. But he comes back home to Aileen. So, fast forward a bit, and you have that conflict where she's like, look, it's been 5 years. Let it go. Let it go. But then he's like, you know, at the end of that day, he's like, oh, you're right. Baby time. I was like, seems a little rushed.
Which I do want to say, like, that, I, again, it was weird. I've never thought of this before, but like when they mentioned that, I'm like, so I'm assuming they are advanced enough to have some sort of really good birth control where you can just decide that it's time to start having kids, because it's apparent that it's been there 5 years and he's probably like, probably at least had sex sometime. So it was,
I mean, it's implied that, yeah, the first night that they have sex, at least implied, if not, well, explicit. Oh, but you know, Philip, to your point, I just wanted to say, like, I actually thought about that. When that second scene happened, when they get into the disagreement and she says it's been 5 years, I thought to myself, well, okay, how long would it take me? How long would it take an average person?
Of every moment of every day reinforcing that this is real.
Yeah. And if I,
and that this person has sort of been your, even if it's not romantic, this person has been your support.
Yeah.
Who, you know, we'll get into, she's an opposite sex, Jean-Luc's presumably attracted to opposite sex people, you know, and so there's, it's not romantic, but there's the, you know, potential there. And so
I thought, you know, I actually thought 5 years was a little excessive. The only issue that I had was, as far as we know, he was never given previous memories of that character.
Right. He doesn't have he doesn't have a past
memory.
They didn't
invent photo albums.
Right. That would be the,
or have a mayor.
Yeah. That would be the only stumbling block. Like, if I never, if I only remembered being Jean-Luc Picard up until 5 years ago, and all of a sudden I have this new life, then that would be easy to dismiss. But if he, I don't know, if they don't make that clear, so it's, I'm not going to put that on the episode, but.
Right. I thought it was a good argument, because you kind of hate her for saying forget it, let it go, because you're like, no, he's Jean, we all know he's Jean-Luc, we all, and so no, but then you're like, well, 5 years, and you know, she's been there, and it feels like he's almost compromising, like maybe he doesn't really want to have a baby, but he owes it to her, like, I don't know, that's probably not the best reason to have a baby, but you know, I guess that's, I almost felt like that's where he's coming from, like, I'm not saying I'm all the way into this, but I'll play along a little bit more. So, and what do you feel about, because we sort of see Jean-Luc characterization, like we get the whole like, oh, you know, I've never wanted children and now I can't imagine my life without them. And so, which is certainly a different character change from sort of, you know, encounter at Farpoint, you know, I'm not a family man, Riker. I'd have to really look at the series to see like how he is after this. I assume this is sort of post disaster because he is playing Frere Jacques on that flute. But I mean, do you buy into like this experience will change Picard, and do we think that it does as we see him later?
Yeah, well, we see him in like Lessons with he plays this with Nella Darren, and
Nella who?
Nella Darren. And so, I mean, we do get callbacks to it a bit till we see his
and he is sort of
flute.
It from that episode, and it's been a while, but I sort of imagine that he's sort of taken this experience but sort of put it in his pocket, you know, it's my experience, I'm not really going to share it or talk about it, you know, and so
true, it's very personal
time. Yeah,
I think too, I was thinking the same thing, I'm like, well, that feels like a very non-Picard thing to say, but at that point, I mean, that was, I guess, established 10 or 15 years into that life. I feel like Picard has taken on that identity at that point. And I still don't think that's a Picard thing to say, like, oh, I never thought I'd want kids, but now I can't imagine myself without them, because obviously he does. He does very much for, as far as we know, from then on, once he gives back being Picard. But I feel like Picard has definitely fully embraced being Kamen at that point, and him as Kamen cannot imagine himself with that, because he's not Jean-Luc Picard at that point. He doesn't even consider himself Jean-Luc Picard.
He's lived a lifetime or half a lifetime.
Yeah, half a lifetime at that point.
How cool would it be if that's what he saw in the Nexus? I mean,
that actually would be a really
aside good from, you know, not quote Beverly and Dickensian era, you know, whatever. Yeah. But like that would actually be really like, and you didn't have to get super specific, but just
he has 50 million children in that one. So
that's true. But yeah, get the same actress back who played his wife and just put them all together. They're happy.
And he could literally be playing the flute in front of the Christmas town tree, you know, that sits there in the front.
Yes, it's because it's a symbol, Daniel. It's a
of
symbol
hope.
Too.
You can't put a price on hope. You might be thirsty.
Really, it just looks like a tree to me.
It would
here,
be way
here to nest.
As Star Trek fans, it would be way less perplexing than having him with some random lady with all these kids. You know, it would actually be a really nice callback.
Okay, so guys, help me remember the episode title. It's a Voyager episode where B'Elanna is given some memories of like a couple that is like a forbidden romance.
Yes. Oh,
I can't remember, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah. She's sort of the Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, kinda. I thought it was Random Thought, which is the one where she has the negative thought, but that was a different one than this. But
that's a much better episode than the one you're talking about.
Well, I'm not saying it's a great episode, but I'm just saying that it's another episode of our characters being imbued with a memory that's not theirs.
Right. Well, in that one, she's, I think, living that character as much as...
Right.
I don't think there's free B'Elanna choice. I also thought, and again, but I was going to say, I, for the Inner Light, I like, again, kind of like with City, that they take their time with the story. It's not, I mean, some of it feels rushed, but not all of it. Like, for instance, when you have sort of the conflict with his son, you know, I'm going to quit school and study music. You know, like, you don't have to put that in there if you don't want to, but that's just sort of a father-son or older father-son moment.
Well, I like the little reoccurring lines of his wife putting away his shoes and him promising he will, like, every day. And even at the very end, where she's like, don't forget to put your shoes. And it's just, that was a great, those are probably three, maybe four times they say that in the whole episode. But it just draws this perfect circle and this thread throughout his life that you could tell this was something, you know, it said a lot with very little.
Also, I also don't know his son's name for the life of me for the second. But anyway, when I heard
Jr.
Patrick's son talking, I was like, why did we choose him for Nemesis? I get it. Tom Hardy's a name. It looks good on the poster and brings in the audience. But I'm like, he would have been a good young Picard for that. Anyway. And he's obviously an actor. But anyway. And I think the only real criticism I have, because again, I don't think it's my favorite TNG episode, but I can see a lot of quality in it. And it's a lot of good to it. And you know, there's a lot of heart into it. But like, oh man, the makeup. Oh man. Yeah.
Yeah, the Picard or Patrick Stewart has aged way better than Kamen.
Well, even the administrator, which by the way, I'm arguing for term limits in Resik, because that administrator has apparently been in office for like 50 years.
I was surprised it was the same administrator. Honestly, I was
like, come on, man, I didn't vote for him.
That's a flaw in the program. The program only has one administrator. They forgot the fact that he wouldn't live that long.
We only have 10 characters in that program. To save it on memory. But anyway, so that's
all the background people are just walking in loops. They don't actually go anywhere.
There's the cat comes back twice and you know it's a deja vu.
So I'm surprised we haven't made any Matrix connections, because it's actually a lot like that if you think about it.
Okay. Well, any final musical thoughts? Any final notes? Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I enjoyed this little reflection of Trek outside of Trek. So, listeners, you know, it's not going to be next week, but I hope to return to this again as we maybe go through DS9 and Voyager and Enterprise. And if anyone has any good animated series recommendations for Trek outside of Trek, I'm all ears.
Are you forgetting any other series there?
I can't really think. No, I mean, Discovery has not had any Trek outside of Trek episodes. No, maybe they will. They all have certainly been on that ship.
It's still a baby. It needs a little more. Wait till it breaks double digits, okay? Let's at least get
we
that
haven't far. Even had its naming ceremony.
That's a good one.
Darren, if people want to get tips for how you conduct a good naming ceremony, you've been through two yourself, where can they reach you on the internet?
It didn't quite go like that, but they can find me on Twitter under username Dr. Sci-Fi or my website, drscifi.com. DRSCIFI.
And Daniel, if people want to talk to you about what things not to put in their hypo spray, where can they reach you?
They can find me on Twitter at Edith Keeler Must Die. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. That's one up Dan. That is the number one. No.
Gosh.
And if folks want to talk to me about why Star Trek is popular when it's not about Star Trek, they can find me at NC Public Servant on Twitter. So, Daniel, what will we be talking about next week?
Okay, well, Philip, you know what? We're gonna stray a little outside of Star Trek. I mean, and by little, I mean
wow, micro. You're really trekking outside of Trek, aren't you?
I am, yeah. A microscopic amount. And we're only going to dedicate one episode to this, at least for now. Maybe sometime in the future we can revisit again. But we're going to talk the Orville, since it obviously has its roots in Star Trek and has been very influenced by Star Trek. We're just going to talk the whole thing, everything that's come out, and all of our thoughts about it. So, yeah, stay tuned for that.
Awesome. Well, that sounds wonderful. Now, am I allowed to drink during that podcast?
Oh, I think you're actually encouraged. And if you have any sort of karaoke that you might be good at, maybe we can get that on the show as well.
I'm Philip Gilfus.
I'm Daniel Prue.
I'm Darren Moser.
Stranded here on City Alpha 3.